was at the Feast of Tabernacles in 2001 that I really began to consider from a firsthand perspective the way that God sees a very important element of life. Now, I'd considered this before intellectually. I'd read the verses, I'd even preached messages about it. But there are some things in life that don't really begin to sink in until you have a close encounter with reality. We were in the Philippines at the Baguio feast site that's in the northern island of Luzon. And on the opening night, there was a lady on the front row with three little boys. They were all wearing white shirts, black pants. She had on a white blouse and a black skirt. Came to realize that that is what they wore every day for the feast, because that was their feast outfit. You couldn't help but notice that their clothes were all clean and pressed and very neat. But you also couldn't help but notice that first night that they seemed very sad. And they were. After services, one of the elders introduced Dee and me to her. Her name was Leonida Jain. Last name was spelled J-A-I-N. She went by Nita. And her boys were Raymond, Jobert, and Niels. And the oldest was 12 years old. They were from the island of Negros, which was about 400 miles due south of where we were. And yes, they were very sad. They were what we would call here squatters. They had found an empty place, piece of land, and some years before they had moved on to it and built a little house. It was by a river, and Mr. Jain, Norberto, made a subsistence living by fishing and raising some vegetables and fruit. 3 weeks earlier, Norberto had been in the river fishing and he cut his leg. The cut became infected, and a few days later he died. So he had died just before they came to the feast. You and I, we would have run down to Emergicare, would have given them our insurance card, made sure our tetanus shots were up to date, got some stitches, and had been done with it, an inconvenience. But for him, it was an excruciating death. Could have had a relatively easy cure had they been of the means and had the ability. But now, Nita Jain was faced with the dire circumstances of having to raise three children alone. As it turned out, I had to go back 3 months later to the Philippines in January to work with some administrative issues over there. But just before my trip, I found out from her pastor, Mr. Florenti Chopin, that a flood had come through and had totally destroyed her home. And it was, you know, an added trial. I asked Mr. Chopin if we had some time, if we could go see her after the meetings, and a few days later, we did. We drove a long distance. It was a couple of hours from the town of Bacolod, where he lived and where the church was. We were driving in the country, and as we came to the bridge that crossed the little river where they lived, there she was standing on the, beside the road on the other side of the bridge waiting for us. And when we pulled up, got out of the car, she walks over, and the first thing she said was, "Welcome to the Garden of Eden." Now, in my mind, as I saw it, that was never what I had pictured the Garden of Eden looking like, but for her, it was her home, and it was a special place. We walked down the path on the bank of the river to see what remained of the little bamboo house, which was now unlivable. Now, the pictures I'm going to show you were not the greatest pictures. They were scanned from prints, but I think you'll get the idea. This is Mr. Chopin and Mrs. Jain indicating how high the water was, and that is her house. It was a bamboo house. So you can imagine anything made of bamboo is not going to be the most sturdy. This picture is Mr. Chopin, two of her boys, Mrs. Jain and Mrs. Chopin, inside their destroyed home, dirt floors. This is two of the boys standing beside their bed in their bedroom, what had been their bedroom. This is Mrs. Hyene looking at the well, that the water well that her husband had dug for water, and now it was just basically filled with rocks and mud. Well, as you can see, their little bamboo house never had a chance against floodwaters. Most of the fruit trees had survived, thankfully. But the most remarkable thing that had survived was her faith. She was unshakable in the midst of all of this, even though she had in such a short time lost some of the most necessary and precious parts of her life. And life had been hard enough, and now it was going to get even worse. It was gratifying to tell her that we would give her some money, and money that came from the United States. And we were going to build her a little house on some concrete piers this time, about 10 feet off the ground, and we would make that available to her. It was very gratifying to tell her that. The next year, I heard from Mr. Chopin that indeed another flood had come, and she and her three boys spent 3 days inside their little house, but high and dry as the waters circulated below them, and they were so thankful. I was glad we could provide that little house for her, but Mrs. Hyene provided something for me, something much more important than money, and that was the beginning of what I mentioned earlier about getting a little better perspective on the way that God sees a very important element of life. Because meeting and talking with her made a deep impression about a very important lesson. Here was somebody who was extremely poor physically, but extremely rich spiritually. Now, she's not the only one. That entire feast was an eye-opener for someone who had never been to a part of the country, like a part of the world like that. I know politically correct doesn't allow us to call it a third world country. We're supposed to call them developing nations. But I will say this, when you go there for the first time, you have entered another world, a world that opens your eyes to a different reality of life. At that feast, Dee and I were given a second floor room in a Girl Scout lodge that was air conditioned, and it was quite adequate. But looking out of our window, we could see a Quonset hut. I suspect it was about as long as this stage from tip to tip. And that's where some members stayed. So one day I went down there and I just knocked on the door and asked if I could come in and meet everybody. And when I walked in, it was one big room with 10 cots on each side. There were 20 people staying there. One bathroom and three different families were spending the feast in that big open room with each other. And it was very striking as we talked for a while. There wasn't a word of complaint. They were happy. They were rejoicing in the feast. They had closely knit families. We were having spiritual conversations. And I found out later that that was a nicer accommodation than what they lived in through the rest of the year. So they were quite happy. And I left there and I thought, these people who are happy to be here, I wonder if I could handle a feast with the same expression of happiness. Could I have been happy for 8 days living with two other families? Anybody want to share Quonset hut sometime for the feast? I thought, I don't know. I don't know if I could have had that in such the same way. Could I have handled it that well? There was another thing. We went from that feast site to Davao, and before the feast, Dee had gone to the dollar store to get some little gifts and trinkets for kids. She enjoys handing those out at the feast, and bought some little cloth bracelets, like 100 of them for $2, and little colorful things. And every day she'd go down and had something to hand out to the kids. And by the third day, they were always waiting at the bottom of the steps. And she went down one morning, and the little thing that she had that morning, you remember, I don't know if they still make them, they probably do. I don't know if kids play with them anymore. Older people will remember the little plastic magnifying glasses about that big around, and you could hold them up, and And as a kid, you had this magnifying glass, but everything's a little distorted, you know. It's not premium ground glass. But she'd brought some of those, and she was handing those out. And there were two elderly ladies standing by the edge of the kids. And as the kids dispersed, these two elderly ladies came up, and she thought they were, you know, wanting one for their grandkids or something. So she gave them a couple of each and turned around. A couple of minutes later, she turned around and saw them sitting in the chairs, their Bibles on their laps, a magnifying glass up to each eye, reading their Bibles. And she started to cry because she realized they didn't want them for their grandkids. They could see better now. And as one of the ministers explained, they can't afford glasses. We could tell many stories like that, but I think it's sufficient for you to understand. When I went back to Sacramento, the first sermon after the feast, the first sentence in my sermon was, Dee and I just met the church at Smyrna. Went on to explain to them what I meant. In Revelation 2 and 3, there are messages to seven churches. Each church had different characteristics. Each one had different strengths and weaknesses. They were in different circumstances. God tells us, whichever one we read about, that the conditions are universal and that anybody who reads about it ought to take heed to what is being said. But one of those churches was the church in the city of Smyrna. And in verse 9 of Revelation 2, it says, I know your works, tribulation, and poverty, but you are rich. That's a bit of an odd way to explain it. I know your works, tribulation, and poverty, but you are rich. How can you live in poverty and be rich? Well, it's not a contradiction at all. God is making a very important statement here. It's important because it tells us something significant about the way he views life, the way he views us. When we mention the word poverty, all of us have different impressions of what that means. The world certainly has its views of the way it defines wealth and poverty. How do we view it? What does God view? How does he view it? As with a lot of things in life, the way God sees things is very different from the way humans tend to see it. When you read more about this church, what he says next about them is not particularly reassuring physically. He said, your condition isn't going to change unless it gets worse. He said in verse 10, do not fear any of these things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful, and after 10 days, you'll get out of it. Now, he said, be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. Can you imagine being in Smyrna and getting this letter for the first time? And wow. Wow. Life is hard. It's about to get harder. That was a pretty bleak outlook for the members in Smyrna. And if they read about the other churches, they could have thought, well, that's not very fair. Look at all the other. Not all are in that same condition. Well, you know, today we have brethren around the world who live in hardship. People who God has called. They're to be lights to the world. We are to be lights to the world. We're all supposed to be. But life is hard for some of them with little promise of change. Mr. Franks talked in this week's In Accord about the members in Malawi and Zimbabwe who are been in the path of that cyclone that went through Mozambique. Hundreds of people being killed. These were some of the poorest nations on earth. And now this. It's even worse. Poverty is oppressive and it is widespread. And among some of the victims are God's people, brethren who barely survive. But it's always been that way. It has always been that way. Was this fair for the brethren at Smyrna? Is it fair for the members in Malawi and Zimbabwe? What about all the other people who don't have to go through things like that? I remember coming home from that feast in 2001, going to a Starbucks and buying a $4 latte. When I sat down, I remembered that a few days earlier, I'd been talking with one of the ministers there who had been given some money to add an extension onto the church office. And he told me, he said, I hired church members to do the construction. Out of curiosity, I said, what do you pay them? And he said, well, I give them a little more than average just to help them out some. He said, they get $4 a day. And I'm looking at my $4 latte, and that's a day's wage. That's a day's wage for those folks over there, people I just met. If we're going to look at fairness, there's not a whole lot of it in the world. It just isn't there. And frankly, nowhere has God promised that it would be that way. That's not where he's fixing things today. But God does promise that out of all the different physical circumstances his people find themselves in, there are going to be great spiritual lessons to learn, things that will change our lives, things that will put us on the road to his kingdom, that will help us appreciate his way of life and to live it the way he wants us to. I hope out of this sermon today will come some lessons that will help us specifically at this time of the year as we are evaluating and examining our lives and the way things should be. The question that I want us to consider today is, how do I measure my wealth? How do I measure my wealth? Now, when I first began to think deeply about this at the feast in 2001, what made the question stand out even more was that, in contrast to what I'd just seen just before the feast, I had to be dealing with several situations where I saw some people with so much physically, who became bitter at God, bitter at the church, or bitter at other people over things of comparatively small natures. And it struck me then, well, they were physically rich, but spiritually poor. How do we look at that? Well, I had, in that situation, I'd met members that I could have said were from another church. They were from another church, the one identified in chapter 3, in verse 17 of Revelation here. Those who say, I am rich and have become wealthy and have need of nothing, and do not know that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. These are all spiritual conditions. The church at Smyrna was describing a spiritual condition. The church at Laodicea was describing a spiritual condition. Which one would we rather have been in? Which one would we have been in had we the choice? You know, since that trip in 2001, I've had many more opportunities to go to other parts of the world and see people who would identify much more physically with Smyrna. That's just the condition they are in. And it makes you think a lot. Economically, we live in a world of haves and have-nots, and many of the have-nots suffer tremendously, and they really don't have much hope of things getting any better. But that's simply the world we live in, and among them are God's people. I'd like to just take a few minutes to introduce you to some of them. These are people I mostly have met one time, but in a short period of time came to respect and appreciate. People who I learned some things from simply by just observing them. People that I think if you had a chance to know them, you would love them as well. This first set of slides, in 2006, I met Kambani Banda, the pastor in Zambia. We were in South Africa, and he asked, can you someday come and visit us in Zambia? He explained that some members had been members there for over 30 years, but they had never had anybody from headquarters or the home office come. He said a couple of council members have been, but nobody from the headquarters. And he said, we're flyover country. We see the jets go by, and we read about the articles of people visiting, but nobody comes to see us. So, you know, he made a very effective plea, and I promised I would, and the next year I was able to do so. Andre Van Belkom, Morgan Kriedemann, and I accompanied Mr. Banda, and we held 8 Sabbath services and Bible studies throughout Zambia and Malawi. We traveled hundreds of kilometers in Mr. Banda's pickup truck. And we saw 347 members in Zambia and 128 in Malawi. Mr. Banda wanted to take us around to see some of the members. And when we were in Lusaka, we visited two church families in their homes. And their homes were fairly close together in a little suburb that you had to almost have a four-wheel drive to get around this suburb. Deep potholes and ruts. The first lady we saw, I wish there was a better picture, but this is Rebecca Chipembele and her granddaughter Alice Banda. We came into her home, which consisted of this little living room, a kitchen, and a bedroom. We talked about the church, talked about how she manages to get to services on the Sabbath. The way she makes a living was with her grocery store. This was a little table in front of her house where she had a few beans and some baskets of little dried fish and some tomatoes and eggs and things like that that she sold in the neighborhood, whoever came by to make a little money. This is a picture of us saying goodbye to her and a neighbor. Again, you can't see these very well to see the conditions, but you can imagine. Mr. Banda told me that a few years ago, Rebecca died. He said she died in the faith. He doesn't know what happened to her granddaughter. From there, we visited this family. This is Linos and Brenda Nguenya, and their children, Nathan, Amos, and Leah. The whole family lives in one room. They put up a blanket at night to make a little curtain to divide it into a bedroom. Now, Linos has a job. He had a good job. Fairly good job, steady, and he had just bought a bicycle, which gave him an advantage. That was a great blessing. The way they went to church, they couldn't do it now, but he would ride the bike to church with his wife and baby sitting on the back, one child on the handlebars and the other child on the crossbar, and that's how they got to church, several miles to go to church. I don't know how they get there now. The kids are probably grown. This goes back to 2007, so you can imagine their circumstances have changed. Just a delightful family. Warm, respectful children. We had a very enjoyable visit. We traveled from Lusaka to Mumbwa, where we stayed overnight before going to a little place called Nalubanda for Sabbath services. The roads are dusty. You start on a paved road, then you go to a gravel road, then a dirt road, then a one-lane dirt road. You're passing places like Mr. Banda pointing out to Mr. Van Belkom. You remember when we got stuck here and the man with the ox had to drag the car out and, you know, things like that. To give you an idea, when we went back, it took us 2 hours and 5 minutes to drive the 40 miles back to the place where we were staying. But you go down that little one-lane dirt road and you think, I have no idea where I am. If anything happens, I am in trouble. And then you round a bend and there's a group of 75 people lined up, waiting to meet you and shake hands and singing a song of welcome to you when you come in before services. And you go into the church and you start meeting people. Some of them say, oh, I've been in the church since 1967. I heard the program on shortwave radio, or somebody came to our village with a magazine and, you know, it just passed around, and God calls people in places that you've never heard of. But God was calling them. Earlier that Sabbath when we arrived, we had to change clothes for services. Mr. Kreteman went into, this was the one house there that we were able to go in and change clothes. And I went in there and noticed there was a rope hanging across with four hangers of clothes, and that was their closet. You know, those were their clothes. After services, we all sat around, had a potluck of a lechwe, which is a type of deer or antelope, and some maize and chicken and goat and vegetables. We departed the next day for another visit to a place called Mapoko. Mr. Franks will be familiar with some of these names. They've been there too. On the way, we picked up some members and again greeted with songs and hugs. The church hall was a mud hut with a thatched roof, and we had 78 people in that building. Most sat on little benches. It's hard for you to probably see. The fellow on the left, that was their seating. If you can imagine coming in here today and sitting on a wood bench about eight inches off the ground and going through 2 hours of that. Well, that was their church hall. They gave us the better seats. This is Mr. Kredeman had the high chair, and Mr. Van Belkom had the good seat. This gentleman had a seat in the back. And after going there, I promised myself I will never, ever complain about chairs at church again. I've had to remember that a time or two, but, you know, tried real hard. After services, we traveled a short distance to visit some members living in their homes. You might have seen these three before. These are three sisters who are widows. And they showed us their crops that they had harvested, the maize and the cotton. Their little village just consisted of some mud huts with thatched roofs. And the sister in the middle is someone that you've probably seen or heard about before, Mary Chisavente. She's been in One Accord, I know. We've made references to her. Mary has a withered leg from a disease that she contracted as a teenager. And to go to Sabbath services each week, she walks 5 kilometers on crutches each way. And she's there every week. This photo was taken inside their home. This is the kitchen. That was their fire that they cook on. This was a typical scene. This was not a church member. It was just a lady in the area walking to get water. They told me that the well was probably 2 miles away. She has to do this every day to get drinking water. It's just a way of life for a lot of people. We then went to another village nearby for lunch, and these were the ladies, the members there, cooking the meal outside. We were seated under a mulberry tree, and we were eating a meal of stewed goat meat and maize and vegetables. This was not the tree that we were under, but I couldn't find the picture of that, but this is indicative. And as we were sitting there, Mr. Van Belkom looked at me and he said, "For those of you who are attending the leadership weekend this week," he said, "I've conducted many a leadership seminar under this tree." And he said, "Never underestimate these people because of their poverty." He said, "I've been here and I've asked somebody, who can explain Colossians chapter 2, the difficult scripture?" And he said, "Hands will go up. I'll call on somebody, they'll stand up and they'll go through and explain all of Colossians chapter 2 very accurately." He said, "They do this because they have no electricity, no TVs, no radios. So at night, they read their Bibles and they study literature. And that's how they are so well versed." Well, it was an honor for us more than for them to be in these homes and hear their dedication to God's way of life. And it just drives the point home that we have the haves and the have-nots physically. But in this world, we have the haves and the have-nots spiritually as well. It's just the way life is. How does God see it? How does He measure wealth? If you take a study of related words in the Bible, blessings, riches, money, a picture begins to emerge. I can give you a quick overview. God early on promised blessings to people. All sorts of blessings. And it's from the hand of God. And many of them were physical. And in the beginning, He promised to Israel great, wonderful blessings. It's very appealing. Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 30, we call the blessings and cursings chapters. And these aren't the only places, but it's very clear as you follow this thread, God wants us to have a good life. And He wants us to have a good physical life. He promised that to Israel, and He gave them tremendous physical blessings. God says, "I'll do this, and you will have a blessed life." It's for the taking, but with a condition. In all of these places, you will find the words, "if." And that "if" ties the blessings to the relationship with God. The blessings are based on that. And that was one of the great lessons of the Old Testament, a history of Israel. And you can see times of prosperity and times of deep trouble. And it was always according to their obedience to God. We come to the time of Christ, and he said something that some religious people have jumped on today and quote a lot, and they use this in a wrong way. In John 10 and verse 10, Christ said, "I have come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly." Now, carnally speaking, we said, "Well, that sounds even better." Many evangelicals, there are branches of evangelical religions today that use this verse to preach what is called prosperity theology. It's also called the prosperity gospel, the health and wealth gospel, the gospel of success, or seed faith. There are different words for it. But it's basically the teaching that financial blessings and physical well-being is always the will of God for everybody, and that faith, positive speech, and especially donations to the pastor will bring heaps of blessings back on you. The prosperity gospel is usually guaranteed to succeed for the one preaching it the most. But there are a lot of people who believe strongly in the prosperity gospel based on that verse. Is that what Christ meant? Is that really what he meant? Well, just like the Old Testament talks about blessings, the New Testament talks about blessings. But as you study and compare, there's an entirely different emphasis. Let's go to Matthew chapter 5. In the Sermon on the Mount, we find Jesus talking about blessings. Now, to the people who heard it, they might have had a little different interpretation than we tend to put on it, because the word has more to do with happiness. The word blessing has a lot more to do with the concept of happiness. But hey, what bigger blessing is there than happiness? You know, happiness is a wonderful blessing. But he lists a whole bunch of blessings here. "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Nothing about the earth. "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall someday inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God." And so far, there's nothing physical here. What about what we read in Deuteronomy and Leviticus? What about my crops? What about keeping evil away? What about good health and full bellies and safe cities and all these things? Something's different here. May not be entirely satisfying to a carnally minded person, and then what comes next really isn't. "Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven." What about here? What about on the earth? This is where I want the blessings. "For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Again, this may not be too exciting to a person whose value system is entirely on the physical. Now, does this mean that Jesus was wiping out everything that was said in the Old Testament about blessings? Does it mean he's not interested in our physical welfare or physical blessings for his people? Not at all. Doesn't mean that at all. He doesn't take away the idea of physical blessings. And we can tell many stories here about physical blessings. How much God has blessed us physically. And there's nothing wrong with that, and we give credit to him. But what he's doing here is adding something to our understanding that is very important about the way we look at life, because now he's beginning to deal with spiritually minded people, not just carnally minded people as he was with Israel. He is redefining and adding to values, and he's teaching his view. Let's go to Luke chapter 12. In Luke 12, Please don't get the impression that I'm talking about how great poor people are, because I'm not. When you travel to those countries, you can see some people are just as carnally minded and have as many problems spiritually as other people do. I'm talking about a perspective. In Luke 12, in verse 13, one from the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" Now, it's not that Jesus wasn't capable of judging perfect judgment. He knew already what the situation was, what was right and what was wrong, but he was saying, "I didn't come. I'm not here now to negotiate civil problems. That's not why I was sent." He was sent to teach us how to judge the most important things in life. And he cut straight to the spiritual issue at hand. Verse 15, he said to them, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses." So what then does life consist of? Christ said he came to give us life more abundantly. And he said right here, though, "I'm not measuring the physical. It has nothing to do with what we possess." So what is his measure of abundance? In verse 15, he goes, or verse 16, he says, he spoke a parable to them, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully, and he thought within himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no more room to store my crops?' So he said, 'I will do this. I'll pull down my barns and build greater, and then I will store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool.'" He was not a fool because he had managed his resources well. He was being a fool because of his approach spiritually toward it all. The way he was managing his spiritual perspective. He said, "This night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." Rich toward God. There's a lot we could talk about in this parable, but let's go directly to the big lesson. What does it mean to be rich toward God? Rich toward God. Jesus said something similar in Matthew 6:20, "Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven." What does God consider a treasure? What means something to God? What is a treasure to him? It's not hard to find the answers in numerous places. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter 1:3. "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." We're coming up to the time of year when we consider the life and death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ and what that means for us. "To an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. You who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you greatly rejoice." When God sees people rejoicing in the hope of his plan, how does he think about them? "Though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials." Those trials vary so much from person to person, but every person has their trials to go through. "That the genuineness of your faith," and here's what God says about it, "being much more precious than gold." The way God sees faith in human beings, he says that is more precious than gold. Gold perishes. "Though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom Having not seen, you love. Let me ask you this. How many people, of the billions who have lived, how many people has God seen through the ages who have had faith like that and who have loved God genuinely, deeply? It's not many. Though now you do not see him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory. If I had sat down with those people in the Philippines and said, well, why are you so happy? I'd be having a miserable feast if I was here sharing with three other families. Why are you so happy? They might not have been able to express it. Maybe they couldn't. I don't know. I'm just happy. There are a lot of things that we can't put our finger on to explain to people why we have a joy about life and a contentment, but it's just there, and God has given that, and it's developed over time. What does that mean to God? You have joy inexpressible and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. That is really important to God. In the Ghana conference in 2013, I was there with Mr. Meeker, and in that conference, he asked Mr. Mundeli, who was the pastor in Rwanda, to tell all the other pastors there what it was like to go through the genocide and the war between the Tutsis and the Hutus a couple of decades previously. It seemed like very few of them in Ghana were even aware of what had happened. As Mr. Mundeli talked, you could have heard a pin drop in that room as he told the stories of people being killed in front of his eyes, right in their yard, harboring refugees, putting their own lives at risk. They finally fled to the Congo, and he told about his son going one day down to the river to get some water, and he never came back, and they don't know to this day what happened to their son. And through all the trials, the faith and the faithfulness that man and his wife have is more precious than gold that perishes. I believe God values that highly, highly. God says, the silver and the gold are mine. They're mine. God already has all of that himself, so how many hearts and minds of people has he had? How much has been given to God in that way by human beings throughout history? It's very rare. In God's sight, faith is a rare commodity. Peter also mentions directly here, faith, love, and joy. Those are three of the elements of the fruit of the Spirit. Mr. Vaughn talked about examining those things. I would urge you to do the same thing. As we go into the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, I can think of no better area to begin examining life by thinking about, okay, how's my wealth measured in terms of love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control? Those are spiritual riches. Those are treasures. When God sees those in us and when Christ returns, those are the things that will be found to praise and honor and glory. Let's go a page or two back to James chapter 2. James 2 in verse 5, James writes, listen, my beloved brethren, has God not chosen the poor of the world? God has chosen people all over the world. And some of them, not all of them, James wasn't saying everybody who's been chosen is poor. But he did say here, when we consider the poor of the world, consider this, has God not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he has promised to those who love him? Now, the context here, he's talking about the way humans look at each other and how we tend to be partial. You know, we you know, we treat people differently. We tend to. And he says, don't do that. He says, the poor have been chosen because sometimes their examples in their poverty, they have nothing left but faith. That they have to believe that there's a better life coming because they don't have a good life now. Now, that's one way to look at it is physically. But another way to look at it spiritually, all of us, spiritually speaking, were dirt poor before God called us. All of us, the carnal mind is dirt poor spiritually. Before God called us, we were all in spiritual poverty, and we all have an opportunity to become rich spiritually. And that's what God is going to be looking at. So he says, and they will be heirs of the kingdom which he has promised to those who love him. Who love him. Faith and love of God are two of those qualities again being mentioned here. Now, let's ask this. Does this verse mean that God has not chosen the rich of the world to be strong in faith too? Is James saying, well, it's the poor people, they've got to be strong in faith. You wealthy people, you know, you're pretty good at that already. No, I won't ask for a show of hands, but if I said how many of us in this room have struggled with faith from time to time, we would all say, yeah, I've been through my battles there. He's chosen all of us to grow in these areas. Being rich in faith is not limited to one's physical standing. James is making a point that God treasures faith. God treasures faith. Now, God has called rich people too. He's chosen the wealthier of the world. And it's all comparative. Most of us may sit here and say, man, all of us may sit here and say, I've seen some wealthy people. You know, I'm in poverty compared to some people I've seen in life. But it's relative because we're all extremely wealthy compared to some other people. So it depends on what we're looking at. But in 1 Timothy 6, in verse 17, we know God has called wealthy people too, because he told Timothy, command those who are rich in this present age. And he was talking about dealing with the church. He said, so command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, not to trust in uncertain riches, because they can leave, they can go away. But in the living God, trust in God, that's faith, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good, that they may be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. People who have more means, but to do the same thing, to lay up treasures in heaven by doing the things that God says, these are really important. Rich in good works, doing good. Again, let me emphasize, just because some church members live in physical poverty doesn't mean they're automatically spiritually rich. And just because some live in physical wealth doesn't mean automatically that they are spiritually poor. That is not the point at all. The point is to never lose sight of that spiritual arena in which God has placed the measurement of wealth. And if we have a poverty of relationship with God, then we're all poor. I think that may be one of the major reasons why you see in some of the biggest cities and the most prosperous countries on earth, God has called people. And in some of the smallest and poorest places on earth, God has called people. From the jungles of Peru and northern Brazil to New York, London, and Paris, God has called people. All different circumstances for us to learn something. In Acts chapter 10, Peter learned something. And again, it was something that he had intellectually understood, But now he really began to see it. Intellectually, the Jews had grown up with the scriptures about how the Gentiles would be called by God and that they would have the truth. But when it actually began to happen, it was a shock to their system. In Acts 10, Peter was instructed to go to the first Gentile family who was going to be called into the church and be given God's Spirit. And I won't go through the whole story, but in verse 34, Peter opened his mouth and said, "In truth, I perceive that God shows no partiality." He said, wow, I get it. Now I really see it. This was a big deal to Peter. When he said, "In truth, I perceive," it was something he had not perceived before. He hadn't really seen it. Verse 35, "But in every nation, whoever fears him and works righteousness is accepted by him." Because these are things that are acceptable to God. These are things that God treasures. Not everybody took it as graciously as Peter. The Jews and the Gentiles had some rocky times in the early church. Seems like every culture, anywhere you go, every nation has another nation that they look down on or make jokes about or maybe even just despise. That's not of God. But God has called us out of all different nations, proving something to us. This is what makes life fair. This is what makes life fair. And this is what makes life abundant. This is what makes for real treasures and real wealth. This is the great equalizer for all people. This levels the playing field in the sight of God. Being rich toward God, storing up treasures in heaven, does not depend on anything else. It doesn't depend on our income. Developing the fruit of the Spirit does not depend on whether you're married, single, or divorced. Developing the fear of God and working righteousness does not depend on which educational opportunities you've been given or have been restricted from. Doing good and being rich in good works does not depend on what race or ethnicity you are. Godliness with contentment is great gain, Paul told Timothy. That has nothing to do with our social status. In fact, every person, no matter their status in life, has to learn godliness with contentment. Has to be. I saw a survey a few years ago where they polled Americans and said, how much more income would you need to think that you could be comfortable? The average was 30%, no matter where they were. If they were in low income, high income, middle income, the average was, if I just had 30% more, life would be good. Isn't it odd? God says, godliness with contentment, man, that's a treasure. Some people are forced into that contentment because they have nothing else. But this is what God treasures. He treasures those who are seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. It means something to him. Our physical conditions have nothing to do with determining how well we can seek the kingdom of God and his righteousness. God is very clear about these spiritual values that true poverty is not a lack of money or possessions. It's not a lack of opportunity, not a lack of experience. True poverty is a lack of spiritual growth and maturity, a lack of spiritual vision. True poverty is a blindness to a spiritual condition. That is something, when Christ said, "I came to preach the gospel to the poor," he was talking about the poor spiritually. Spiritually. God is showing us today by the people that he is calling that he's truly no respecter of persons. Job 34 and verse 19 says, "He is not partial to princes, nor does he regard the rich more than the poor." And he doesn't regard the poor more than the rich. Job was a rich man. He says they are all the work of his hand. God is working in the lives of everyone he has called, And the poorest person in the church today in the most impoverished country in the world is still having to examine themselves in the same way we are in preparation for the Passover. The same things, spiritual condition. As we examine ourselves, we will find that we will be in one of four different quadrants. We will all be in one of four different quadrants. The first is, it is possible to be spiritually poor and physically rich. The parable of the seed and the sower, one of those, Jesus said, talks about the deceitfulness of riches choking the word. There's something there that we need to think about, the deceitfulness of riches. What does that mean? In a material culture that values physical wealth, the morally and spiritually weak will fail. The second quadrant, it is possible to be spiritually rich and physically poor. Many people of God have been in this condition. We have to be willing to think about losing everything in life. You know, it could happen, and maintaining the spiritual wealth that God wants us to be having. The third quadrant, it is possible to be both spiritually poor and physically poor. This is something you see in a lot of areas of the world today, where there is poverty, but there's also immorality and crime and just a lack of any basic spiritual foundation, and it makes the poverty worse, and it just, you know, it feeds itself in a very dangerous and bad way. Actions that lead to more poverty. And the fourth quadrant, it is possible to be both spiritually rich and physically rich. The Bible gives great instruction to us about how to appropriately handle physical blessings, physically, mentally, spiritually, so that we keep our lives in a proper balance. Abraham was a great example of someone who was spiritually rich and physically rich. In all fairness, you know, the stories I've told you today were about those in poverty. I could have spent just as much time telling you about people who've been physically blessed and have done so much good, who have been so much like Abraham, spiritually rich as well as physically. We have a lot to learn from their examples. My point, I hope everybody has that clearly, is not that one is better than the other, but to consider what God's values are and to ask, are those the most important things to me? Sometimes stories, though, like I told you, help drive lessons home, though, in very powerful ways. July and August 2016 Discern, I wrote a column about being in the Philippines in January of 2002. Same trip I went to see Mrs. Hayin. On the Sabbath, the Chopins invited me to their home after services. They said, come to our home. We're going to have a barbecue. Their home was on a little lot, a little city lot, and they had originally built their house. And as their children got older, they built another house. Each child got married, and they built houses in each corner of this little lot. Small houses. Three out of the four corners were taken up, so they were waiting for another one to get married, I guess. And in the middle between all the houses was a little tiny courtyard, and that's where we had the barbecue that night. The barbecue was a tinfoil pan, like we would cook a turkey in. They put coals in the bottom and had some chicken pieces on skewers going across, and we had a lot of rice and a lot of fruit and vegetables. It was a lot to eat. We enjoyed it, and we were just enjoying the company in the evening when one of the boys rolled out of one of the houses. He rolls out a karaoke machine onto the patio. And Mr. Chopin told me, he said, we don't have enough money to go to movies or out for entertainment on Saturday night. So a while back, we all talked about it, and we decided if we pulled our money and we saved and saved, we would buy a karaoke machine. He said, this is what we do on Saturday night. We have the family. We have some members that we invite over. And we have a meal out here. And then we sing. So he hooked it all up. Mr. Chopin started off. He was sitting on a chair. He had a grandbaby on each knee. And he went through some of the CDs. And I don't know if it was Dean Martin or Frank Sinatra, but he picked one of those. And he started it off, grandbaby on each knee, singing into his mic. It was remarkable to watch. And when he finished, someone else got the mic, and it might be two or three or solos. But we spent the next 3 hours singing songs, talking, eating leftover food, visiting. And I spent a lot of time watching. See, about 20 people spanning three generations. And every Saturday night, they were together as a family, singing, visiting with other people, genuinely enjoying one another, deep affection for one another, enjoying very simple things in life because they didn't have enough for life to get very complicated. They were together. And I stood there and watched that all evening and thought, do you need what we have, or do we need what you have? They had a lot going on. Thought about that a lot. On that trip to Malawi in 2007, we had lunch in a member's home, again in a poor area. And I saw a sign hanging on the wall. And on that little sign was written, "What shall I give back to God? What shall I give back to God?" That illustrates a type of wealth. People who have so little physically to give, but they're thinking, what can I give back to God? It's a wealth of spirit. It's a wealth of attitude. I've seen that same spirit and attitude among all different strata, economically, of God's people. Those who are seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. God wants to work in all of us to understand what his true riches are. What does God consider riches? What does he think of? Is it someone with everything they could possibly want, but they're not truly seeking first his kingdom and his righteousness? Or someone who's barely able to put food on the table, but is humble and growing spiritually in their hearts, are in God's work? Who is richer? Someone with a ton of automobiles, but with vanity and pride? Or someone who rides a bike to church, toting four other people on it, who is humble in the sight of God? Who is richer? Someone who, if they lost all of their possessions, would also lose their faith in God? Or someone who has no possessions and has tremendous faith in God? I should tell you the rest of the story about Mrs. Hyene, Nita Hyene. She died a few years ago, cancer. She died quite rich. They discovered gold on, no. She didn't discover any gold. She died in the same physical conditions. She wasn't rich because of she adopted the prosperity gospel. She wasn't rich because they struck oil on her property. She wasn't rich because of gaining some inheritance from some unknown long-lost relative. She died rich according to Proverbs 15 and verse 6. Proverbs 15, 6, that says, "In the house of the righteous, there is much treasure." In the house of the righteous, there is much treasure. Doesn't matter what their financial status may be, rich or poor, in the house of the righteous, there are things that God treasures. You can consider this today a pre-Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread sermon. Had very little in it directly about the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread, but I hope that by presenting this topic in this manner, you have found some things to examine in preparing our hearts to take the Passover humbly and to pursue the righteousness of God that unleavened bread represents. Someday, there will be a time when all the physical conditions in this unjust world All the things that God's people have put up with and that all humanity has put up with just won't matter anymore. Won't matter to us. We'll be changed into spirit beings and we'll be able to start turning the world around to where it will become a world that has no injustice and doesn't suffer the way it does now. And when that change comes, you'll have the chance to meet some of these people you've seen today. And those people will rejoice in meeting you. I'd like nothing more than to see Mrs. Hyene meet all of you as well. We'll all be meeting and getting to know and be rejoicing with our brethren around the world and throughout history. But being at that meeting will depend on how rich we are, rich in the things of God.